From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Dr. Richard Wolff is a visiting professor at the New School University in New York and a professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, as well as Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He also hosts Economic Update. He's considered the leading Marxist economist in the U.S. today. And Dr. Wolff spoke at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church in Los Angeles on April 24th, 2018, at an event organized by KPFK. Today, we'll play for you a lengthy excerpt from that talk.
Another world is possible. There's no question about it. Many of you know that I advocate for worker co-ops as an alternative way to organize an economy, and I'm going to say a few more things about that. But this evening, the central theme I want to develop is one that also talks about another world possible, but lays out for you, I hope, a persuasive argument that might be just a touch scary. That it's not just that another world is possible, but the one we've grown up with is disintegrating and cannot survive, and that we are in a completely new situation in which the basic question for all of you as individuals is whether or not you might be living in a system that is disintegrating and whether or not you're prepared to let it take you down with it. Let me try to make the case that capitalism is in a new phase. And the way I like to do it is historically by reminding everyone that every economic system in the history of the world can be described as having been born, having evolved and changed over time, and then having died and disappeared. Ancient village economies, ancient communal systems, slaveries, feudalisms, they all conform to that pattern. Why in the world should anyone believe that capitalism, unlike every other system in human history, was born, evolved over time, and then never died at all? And if you can see that this makes no sense, such an assumption, well, then you have to ask the question, where are we in the history of capitalism? At the beginning, in the middle, or dot, dot, dot? Every system, when it was riding high, had people in it who believed it was the best system the world could ever have, would last forever, was the chosen way that God himself or herself, I don't want to offend anyone, chose. And capitalism is full of people who think that this is the best system since sliced bread. It will last forever. It is superior to anything and everything else that might exist. Why in the world should we take that seriously? Why should we take it seriously if the economics of our society, which I have spent my life as a professor of, is 99% composed of people who have never, for an instant, taken seriously the proposition that our economic system could or would or should be organized in a non-capitalist way? It's extraordinary if you think about it. And nowhere is this more true than in the United States, where this notion of the perfection and the perpetual nature of capitalism has been axiomatic for the last half century. It's extraordinary. Now, I want to give you some arguments about why the unspeakable, the unsayable, the unrecognizable end of a system is unfolding around us. There are many ways I could start, but here's a few. In December of last year, after a 40-year period in which inequality in this society rose starkly, in which corporate profits and a stock market boom we had never seen before unfolded, making the rich, after all, a tiny percent of people own the bulk of the shares, et cetera, where the rich became remarkably richer than they had been, when we are able to talk about an economy where Jeff Bezos owns $129 billion of wealth, at least the last time I looked. Why in the world would a society with that history decide to pass a tax reform bill that makes the corporations richer by a big factor? Corporate profits tax was cut by 40%. Why in the world would you do that? That is a society that is completely out of control, in which the people at the top have lost any constraints or limits on what it is they think they can, and indeed should do, proudly proceeding to say, yes, we have become richer than ever before. Yes, the 40 years have made us richer than everybody else. And now what we need most in America is a tax cut that will give us even more. Extraordinary. That's a sign of a society that's falling apart. That's the beauty of the dialectic. The very assertiveness of the top 1% is so out of control that a growing percentage of them understand it too. Need to step forward like Warren Buffett and say, this is crazy what we are doing here. Turning to his fellow businessmen and women and saying, hey, 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 slow down. We are spinning out of control here. We mustn't do this. And I'm no fan of Warren Buffett, and the last thing I want you to do is be one. But it's a sign of a system when the people at the top themselves include growing numbers who understand this is not sustainable. Here's a second piece of information to put this thesis before you. In the great crash of the 1930s, one of the most remarkable things that happened was the upsurge from the American people, from below, a radical, well-organized demand for the society to not obey the rules of capitalism, but instead obey the rules of solidarity among people. You do all know the story, I won't repeat it. Just the outline. Americans, frightened by what the Depression meant, joined labor unions in unprecedented numbers. They were led, I'm going to say that again, they were led by the most militant members of the labor movement, a large portion of whom were members of two socialist and one communist party here in the United States. And they worked together, the communists and the socialists and the labor movement in the CIO, to present Mr. Roosevelt, the president at that time, with a stunning demand. You must help the mass of people. If you don't, we won't vote for you for president and you're going to be out of here. And the socialists and communists giggled and added the little extra note, and if you don't do something, we're going to make a revolution here. And Mr. Roosevelt went back to his business associates and the wealthy people, among whom he counted himself correctly, told them the story, and got half of them to become frightened that if they didn't do something, they wouldn't have the wealth they had anymore. And so Mr. Roosevelt turned around and created a social welfare state for a while, the New Deal. He created the Social Security system, the unemployment compensation system, the first minimum wage, and a public employment program that put roughly 15 million people to work between 1934 and 41. Of course, Bernie Sanders is coming up with that idea, because it's part of American history to do that. It has nothing to do with socialism or communism or anything else. It worked really well. It worked so well that the United States was able to fight World War II with a unified country instead of a divided one. It enabled the United States to avoid going down the fascist road of Italy and Germany as their way of coping with the Great Depression. We didn't go that way. Even though there were plenty of forces in the United States, then as now, who would have gone that way? We didn't. Here's the irony. What saved the capitalist system, the kind we're used to in the United States, what saved it was precisely the opposition of unions, socialists, and communists. They're the one that forced the government to help the masses of people. And for those of you with a little economics, you know, if you help the mass of people, you give every person 65 years of age or older a Social Security check every month, and you give unemployed people compensation the way we began to do, and you create a minimum wage that raises the income of those at the bottom, and then you put millions of people to work, you know what happens? All those people have money that used to be unemployed, and when they spend the money, they create the revenues for the capitalist enterprises. You might call that trickle-up economics, because that's what it is. It's the alternative to the other approach called trickle-down, when you give all the benefits to those at the top and you hope that it trickles down. But the difference between the two policies is we know it'll trickle up, because if you give poor unemployed people anything, they spend it. We know it from countless exams of the situation. Just as we know that you give people at the top the money, it's an iffy proposition how much of it ever trickles down. We know. But despite the fact that we know, that's not what made it happen. What made it happen in the 1930s, and let's remember when Mr. Roosevelt was elected, he was a middle-of-the-road Democrat who advocated fiscal responsibility and balanced budgets in his campaign. He wasn't the FDR we remember, because that wasn't the FDR at that time. The FDR we remember is the FDR fashioned by the pressure from below of the CIO and the socialists and the communists. And they saved this system. They saved it from a fascist alternative with God knows what results would have come out of it. Here's the irony and the sign of a system in deep trouble. After the war, that alliance of the unions, the socialists, and the communists was systematically destroyed. It was destroyed by an alliance of the government, big business, and the most reactionary social forces in this country, who got together in a manner that ought to remind you of Donald Trump. The same forces. And they went to work to destroy not Mr. Roosevelt, he had already died, but the alliance that made Mr. Roosevelt shift from a middle-of-the-road Democrat to the one we remember. And here's how they did it, just to remind you. They converted communists from the most aggressive leaders of the drive to unionize and change America. So they weren't the great militants that indeed they were, but they were the agents of a foreign power. If I had more time, I'd rev up some music now to give this the force that I want you to associate with it. After they had converted communists into the dangerous agents of a foreign power lurking under your bed at night and threatening everything you hold dear, including your dog. When that was done, they went around the country, the same people, and they went after the socialists with a deeply analytical argument that socialists are just like communists. They just spell it differently. Some of you know, because I've said it before, that when I first began teaching in the United States, here, I couldn't understand why my students used the following words synonymously, as synonyms: communist, socialist, anarchist, terrorist, Marxist, and in many parts of America, liberal. It's all the same. I was particularly struck by the communist socialist, because if you go to any European country, everybody knows very clearly what the difference is. At first, I thought Americans were just kind of uneducated, but that was a mistake. Americans were subject after World War II to a systematic program of equating socialists, communists, and all those others as a way to demonize and reject all of them indiscriminately. It's not stupidity at all. And once they got gotten rid of the communists and socialists, they went after the labor movement. You know that. Right from the beginning, 1947, Taft-Hartley law. A law which required that any gain that any union ever won at any workplace would have to be given to everyone at that workplace, whether or not he or she was a member of the union, whether or not he or she paid dues to the union, and whether or not he or she participated in the strike actions of the union. In other words, here's an incentive for every single person to quit the union, to stop paying dues, because they would get the benefits whether they did or not. Only a violently anti-union society would do such a thing. And it worked. This society destroyed precisely the alliance, the political alliance, that saved it from going in the direction of fascism a la Europe, and particularly Germany and Italy and in Asia, Japan. Which means that when the next crisis happens, 2008 and 9, we have a replication of what happens in 1929, but with this one salient difference. There is no alliance of labor, socialists, and communists. There are no communists effectively left. There are very few socialists left, and the labor movement is a pale shadow of what it had been. There is no one left to save capitalism from its worst tendencies. That's why we only have trickle down since 2008, no trickle up. That's why the inequality that helped produce the crisis has gotten worse since then, not better. That's why we have the laughable joke that the banks that were too big to fail back then are bigger now than they were then. That's why the latest numbers indicate to us that banks are once again making subprime loans on a massive scale for housing, for automobiles, and so on. Because rates of return are so low in a low interest environment, they have to find the rates of return somewhere else in the riskiest imaginable assets. This is a society that is not learning real well from its own history. And that's a sign of a society breaking down. Let me give you another piece of evidence. All my colleagues in economics, right-wingers, left-wingers, and those in the middle, roughly would agree to the following sentence: that the future of the American economy lies in the quality and the quantity of the labor force it can offer to the world. The single most important institution in developing the quality and the quantity of our labor force are public schools of higher education. 3/4 of all students that go to college and university in America go to a public school. Private higher education is a small part of the story. Public higher education is the major part. Not even close. With the exception of one state, the immense, large, and powerful state of North Dakota, every other state has cut the funding for public higher education. Let me do that again. The future of the United States is in the quality of the public higher education establishment, and 49 out of 50 states are cutting it. raising the prices of public higher education. At a time when jobs are scarce and incomes are stagnant, it means that young people have to borrow more and more money to get that education whose price is rising because the public support is shrinking. If you make the cost of higher education huge debts that can hardly imaginably be paid, you're decreasing the incentives, you're decreasing the likelihood that people are going to pursue higher education. As the price goes up, you make it more expensive. In other words, at a time when you need to improve public higher education for the future of your society, you are in the process of effectively shooting yourself in the foot. Assuming Americans are not backward people, stupid people, you have to ask the question, why would a society of perfectly reasonable people shoot itself in the foot in the middle of a situation where every advisor on the subject would argue to do the opposite of what is in fact being done? And all of that in the name of fiscal responsibility, or junk language like that in which our professors and our journalists and our politicians are experts. This is a society that is behaving fundamentally irrationally. And I haven't even mentioned who we elected as president. But there too is a symptom. He's not so different from what other politicians in presidencies have done. He's not that different from the Republican Party, most of whose demands he articulates and carries out. But he is bizarre. He is strange. He is as irrational as an individual as the policies I've just gone through with you are irrational as social phenomena. Wrap all this together, you have a society that isn't working real well. The United States has championed quote-unquote free trade for a long time. Now granted, that championship is largely phony. We haven't had free trade. You might argue we've had trade a little more free or less unfree than it once was, but free trade we don't have. And I can see from the faces of some of you that maybe I need to spell this out. There's a lot of ways for me to do it, but here's one. One of the things that Mr. Trump recently proposed was that he was going to put tariffs and other kinds of penalties on Chinese goods because the Chinese had a 25% tariff on American automobiles. So if an American automobile was produced here and shipped to China, whatever the price was, it would go up by 25% because it couldn't enter China without paying this tax on an imported good, which is called a tariff. And this, Mr. Trump said, was a terrible thing, created great unfairness, and he would not allow it.
Thank you.
So before we get into a discussion of your book, I'm wondering what you make of this recent vote by the House with 33 Democrats joining Republicans to pass this bill that chipped away at the Dodd-Frank regulations. People are calling this a compromise. Do you think that it is?
Even some of you in
Well, I think Dodd-Frank was already a compromise. I mean, I think Dodd-Frank should have been Glass-Steagall opinion statement, which would have avoided a lot of these problems because then small banks would have done what they do, and big banks would have had less capital
Many years ago, 1963, the United States of America imposed, interestingly, coincidentally, a 25% tariff on trucks produced outside the United States and brought in to the United States. That 25% tariff has been in force since 1963 and right to this minute. If you want to understand why in the United States there is this very peculiar fetish of the truck, large numbers, particularly of young men, seeming to think that the possession of a truck is a quality that conveys manliness rather than the clumsy dimensions of an overpriced, gas-guzzling, unnecessary addition that won't fit in the garage. It has nothing to do with manliness. It has to do with a tariff enabling profits on trucks to go off the charts compared to profits on cars. It became necessary for American companies to persuade the public that a sexy automobile was a pickup truck. And only ... would buy a regular car. This was because we protected truck makers and correspondingly Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, and everybody else began to produce and sell trucks. And we began to tell ourselves the bizarre story that Americans are in love with trucks. No, they aren't. They're in love with profits. And trucks bring more of them than cars do. And why? Because we jack up the price. We don't let foreigners bring in their cheap trucks because we make them pay a 25% tariff, which makes it possible to produce trucks here and charge just a little less than those imported ones. We don't have to pay the tariff here, do we? That's all profits. It's a lesson in economics, but more than that, in what kind of a society can the president talk endlessly about the importance of doing away with the unjustness of a tax in China of 25% on cars? A president who presides for the last half century on a 25% tariff on trucks. Stunning. And if you didn't know what I just told you, that's the point. You didn't know. You don't know. You are left to live in a society which is producing an absurdity, threatening a trade war with another country for doing, for a shorter period of time, what we have been doing as a nation for a longer period of time. This is bizarre. This is not normal. This is a society that needs to go further and further away from all rational discourse. It's the same kind of irrationality as is involved in cutting your public higher education and in giving a tax cut to corporations after 40 years of favoring them 2,700 other ways. It is, in short, extraordinary. I want to pick up on one last example, again, borrowing from Alan Minsky. That's right, the Queen of England asked why economists hadn't foreseen. She shouldn't have asked the question, since royalty is, if anything, blinder than economists. Granted, it's not a high bar, but nonetheless. Nobody saw it. And why did nobody see it? Well, almost no one. There's a man named Rubini in New York. He saw it. And there were others. But they don't get listened to very much. Mr. Rubini, I believe he's still called Dr. Doom, or one of those phrases that...
That's an excerpt of a recent speech by Dr. Richard Wolff given at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church in Los Angeles on April 24th, 2018. You can access the whole speech at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Also find out more about our show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.